And there are ghosts there, good ghosts. And I think that is part and parcel of walking into a space that has been there for so long. It's affected so many people's lives. You can't help but to feel these spirits. I'm happy to report that they're all positive.
Hey, everybody. You are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond, coming to you from Newsstand Studios at Rockefeller Center in the heart of New York City. Today's guest is Sohee Kim, chef and co-owner of Gage and Tolner, the historic Brooklyn restaurant that she and her team have breathed new life into. Sohee is also the chef and co-owner of Insa, a fun Korean barbecue and karaoke spot also in Brooklyn. And she is the author of two cookbooks, Korean Home Cooking, Classic and Modern Recipes, and the Good Fork Cookbook. So he joins us today to talk about Gage and Tolner, the history behind the restaurant, the menu, the Edna Lewis connection, and the community that chipped in to help resurrect the historic space. I'd like to thank today's sponsor, Kerrygold, the maker of beautiful Irish butter and cheese made with milk from grass-fed cows. We'll hear more from our friends at Kerrygold in just a minute. And Sir Kensington's, the maker of some of my favorite condiments. My fridge actually temporarily died the other week, long story, and my first reaction was, my condiment collection. Sir Kensington's has a fun new honey mustard fry sauce that you can snag right now on Amazon. Use it straight up or get creative and make your own sauce or vinaigrette. You can find the link for the fry sauce in our show notes. I'd also like to thank everyone who came to our Cooks and Books celebration the other week at Ace Hotel Brooklyn. The team and I had so much fun celebrating the best cookbooks and authors of the season, including The Korean Vegan, Valerie Lomas, and Sama Dada. Thank you to the Ace Hotel Brooklyn, Le Creuset, and Maple Hill Creamery for their support. Now, a quick word from our friends at Kerrygold, and then my conversation with Sohee Kim.
Kerrygold is delicious, all-natural butter and cheese, made with milk from Irish grass-fed cows. Our farming families pass their craft and knowledge from generation to generation.
I'm fifth generation. It goes back over 250 years.
This traditional approach is the reason for the rich taste of Kerrygold. Enjoy delicious new sliced or shredded Kerrygold cheddar cheese. Available in mild or savoury flavours at a retailer near you. Find your nearest store at KerrygoldUSA.com.
Sohee Kim, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you so much. So great to be here.
Welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. It's been a while.
It's been a minute.
You've had a few things going on since the last time we spoke to you.
Just a little bit. Just a little bit.
So we are going to talk about Gage and Tolner.
Yes.
Today, your beautiful restaurant. And as I was working on the questions, I realized that my questions basically could be condensed into who, what, where, when, why, and how. So I thought it might be fun to just go through those.
Sure.
And we're going to start with the who. So, two-part question. Who were Gage and Tolner? Were they real people?
They were absolutely real people. They were partners in the beginning. Actually, they didn't start out together. It was really Gage, and then Tolner sort of bought in a couple of years later. Gage and Tolner, you know, it dates back to 1879, but it doesn't actually date back to 1879 at the place that we're in now, which is 372 Fulton Street. Actually, Gage had another space, I think, a few doors down. And when Tolner sort of came on, they got into this building, 372, and they were there for a really, really long time. And a great partnership, it sounds like, based on all of our, you know, historical research. The other big history aspect in terms of ownership is the Deweys. And then they had it for, I think, about 70 years.
And were Gage and Tolner restaurateurs, chefs? Who were they?
They were not really. I mean, you know, Fulton Street, Fulton Mall, which didn't exist. It was just Fulton Street. There was a lot of oyster carts, and that's how this business sort of started, as like an oyster cart, you know, place where you could just get quick oysters, something to eat. Actually, St. John is sort of the history buff in this whole thing, that they were not necessarily restaurateurs, but they were certainly interested in having a restaurant and getting into hospitality. So yeah, a great partnership.
People might not realize back then New York was practically paved with oyster shells.
That's right. That's right.
Oysters everywhere.
Yeah.
And who is the who today?
Who is the who today? So I guess the story with us starts back about 4 years ago when St. John Frizzell, our dear friend, and he has been in the industry along with us. He owns Fort Defiance, and he had this little pop-up, I guess you could say, on Thursdays called Sunken Harbor Club. He's been at Fort Defiance for a little while, and he said, it's time for me to do something different, like a second project. And we had just opened INSA, and we said, oh, that sounds like a great idea. And he really wanted to do this Sunken Harbor Club somewhere downtown Brooklyn. And so he said, okay, so he will you consult on a menu, like a short, concise, really sort of cool bar menu to go with my drinks. And, you know, he has this whole history and like philosophy behind Sunken Harbor Club, and he really geeks out in it, and I love to hear him talk about sort of this history of this make-believe sort of club. So Ben and Sinjin went out looking for
and Ben is
a
your
space.
Husband.
And sorry, yeah, Ben Schneider, my husband, my partner in crime. We have opened the Good Fork together in Seb. And so his role was going to be sort of, you know, get a tiny little space and renovate and, you know, infrastructure, building. I would do the food menu and Sinjin would do his amazing cocktails. So it was a very simple idea. Okay, let's just find a place. And Sinjin wanted a small place, a tucked away place somewhere in downtown Brooklyn because he really, really wanted to be there. Anyway, they looked at a whole handful of places. The real estate agent was getting a little frustrated because they weren't liking any of the spaces that they saw. So it was a last ditch effort. She's like, I'm going to show you guys something different. It's not what you're asking for. And it was Gage and Tolner. She opens the door. Ben and Sinjin walk in. Their jaws drop. And they're like, oh my God, this place. We remember this place. So that's how it all sort of started, you know, to open up a tiny little, you know, speakeasy bar with a cool, really cool concept to, you know, finding this crazy historic landmark space that hasn't been operational, you know, for like 14 years, but dates back to 1879. And as soon as they said, okay, this is what we're going to do next. And I said, are you guys crazy?
So that kind of covers the who and a little bit of the where. The what?
The what?
So how did it go from Sunken Harbor Club to a full blown out historic restaurant.
Right. So many details there, right? So do we abandon Sunken Harbor Club and open up this place and then look for another space? Well, once they looked at the space, they realized that it's pretty much three floors of this historic building, the main floor, which is landmarked, as I said. So there would be enough room to put the Sunken Harbor Club upstairs above Gage and Tolner. So then it became this whole new conversation about what, like how, you know, these very key questions. How much? How do we do it? Who does it? We set out to obviously, you know, write a business plan, as all, you know, responsible business people should. But it really was a shared sensibility of what the vision of this place would be.
Did they have to talk you into this? Because this was a radically different idea.
Yes. I laughed at them. You know, and I've said this over and over again before. It's like sending two little boys for like a quart of milk and then come back dragging a live mooing cow. And you're like, are you nuts? So there was a lot of like disbelief. I can't believe you're thinking that this is what we're going to do because the original idea was so small and quaint. Well, then Sinjin hits the library, you know, and he starts sending us all kinds of historic archives of menus and who the former owners were, you know, the history of the building, all the important kooky things that have happened over the years. And you cannot help but to be sucked in to the drama and the history. Mm-hmm. And so we just became, you know, food history nerds of just, and then I found out Edna Lewis was there.
Yeah, that's a big, important part of the history.
Huge part, yeah, especially as it pertains to the menu that we have now. So anyway, so yes, there was a lot of like, you're crazy, I'm not doing this. Because you know why? We have nothing else to do right now. We don't have individual other restaurants and families to take care of. It just felt incredibly too much. But then once we broke it down, and once we really saw the potential of the place, you just get smitten with this idea. And then also, Carrie, just being in that space, and you've been in there, I think, various stages of sort of construction, renovation, to the day, actually, a week before we actually opened, what we're supposed to open the first time around, you just get so wrapped up. And there is a feeling in there of warmth and history and all these great things. And it really became, let's do this. We really want to do this. And we have to do this. And then, of course, the how.
As you mentioned, it's landmarked. It's interior landmarked.
It is. It is the third interior landmark space of New York City, next to Grant's Tomb and the New York Public Library.
Because it's mostly exteriors that are landmarks,
right?
Right?
That's right.
And
right.
not the interior. So you couldn't technically do that much to the main dining room.
We couldn't do that much to the main dining room. It is interior landmarked as well as exterior landmarks.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Wow.
So we still had to like deal with the Landmarks Commission in terms of what we could do with the facade, what paint, you know, how do we sort of make it right. But obviously, you know, Ben Schneider, my partner, my husband, he was so excited about this project. Only because he was coming out of a project, INSA, which is our Korean barbecue place in Gowanus, and that was sort of a blank slate for him. It was a warehouse space. There was nothing in there, no HVAC, no plumbing. So he was really able to do everything from scratch and really adhere to his own design sensibilities and what we sort of envisioned for that particular space for INSA. But with Gage and Tolner, it was really challenging, right? You can't just make all these decisions on your own unilaterally. You have to work with the commission, work with the architects. He definitely saw a challenge in renovating or bringing back sort of the glory. And he jumped right in and learned so much and had so much fun. And of course, he didn't do it by himself. He had a group of amazing project managers, architects, and, you know, lovely designers and a lot of charrettes. I remember sitting like cold. There was no heat in there and just sitting around and looking around and seeing the Lincrusta and the ceiling and just envisioning what could be. And that was the most fun. And it was pretty dilapidated because it had not been a restaurant since 2004. So there was a lot to go over. There's a lot to learn, but it was incredibly fun.
So when you walk in, those chandeliers you see are original.
Yeah.
The bar that you see has been there for
Decades? Since about 100 years.
Wow.
About 100 years,
And when you walk in and you think Edna Lewis leaned on that bar.
Yeah.
It just blows your mind.
Yeah, and had her bourbon and had a cigarette, you know? Like you could you could envision all of this stuff.
You could. Yeah. It's a magical space in that sense. You do feel like you can see the past in there and you can see ghosts almost swirling around in a good way.
Oh, absolutely. And there are ghosts there. Good ghosts, you know, I believe in the spirit world to a certain extent. And you just have to, and I think that is part and parcel of walking into a space that has been there for so long. It's affected so many people's lives. You can't help but to feel these spirits. I'm happy to report that they're all positive and good spirits.
Good. I'm glad the spirits are happy. And we will talk about Edna Lewis before this show is over. So let's talk about the when.
Mm-hmm.
When you took it over, when you were hoping to open, and when you actually did open.
Yeah, so you know, it happened pretty quickly. The project for us dates back about 4 years ago, in that that's when we saw the space and started planning. Obviously, the key component of this is finances and money. It took us about 2 years to raise all the funds. And, you know, that got a little hairy. Like, we didn't know, like, how to approach it. And we ended up doing this amazing crowdfunding campaign that raised about $500,000. And then that allowed us to get amazing, about 40 investors, you know, who were really supportive and believed in the project. So that took a while. And by the time we had everything done, it was 2019. And it was February. If my partners were here, they could double check me on that. But I'm pretty sure that that was it, February 2019. And Ben and the team and all of us, we sort of boogied to get everything sort of together, you know. And we scheduled the opening for December of that year, obviously. But, you know, all these big projects get pushed back and pushed back. So finally, we said, okay, March 15th, that's how we're going to do it. And then you know what happened.
Everyone knows what happens.
Yeah.
March 15th is my birthday, so I remember that you were supposed to open that day, and March 13th, Friday the 13th, was pretty much the day everything shut down in New York, and I thought of you through this whole time. It is so hard to open a restaurant of any size, and I knew how long you three had worked on this one. Were you just hoping up until the city shut down, or did you know?
No, we knew, you know, that Friday the 13th, we actually opened, you know, that day in the morning, we all got together, you know, our team, our core team, our general manager, executive chef, all of us. And we said, this feels weird. I feel like maybe we should just shut it down. And then some one of us said, no, these, you know, started calling some reservations and people, and they're like, we're coming. We won't shake your hand, but we're coming. And there was still so much enthusiasm. We opened and it felt normal for a little while. But obviously, I'm sure, you know, it wasn't a good idea to, but we had to. But then the next day, it got worse, and we said, you know what, there's no way, we can't keep fooling ourselves. So we made the decision on that Saturday and didn't have the last day of soft open. And then that's when we decided to send everybody home, cook a ginormous family meal for everybody there, and then sent people with food, started pickling things, and then threw some stuff in the freezer. Like, who knew? Like, we thought maybe 3 weeks and we'll see everybody back here again.
We thought the same thing. Our office at the time was walking distance from Gage and Tolner, and we were so excited to be part of downtown Brooklyn. And we packed up, put everything in the storage facility down in Gowanus, and thought we would be back to normal in a few weeks.
That's right. And that really was a belief. And there was like, okay, we've run so hard. Like, this is a good break. We'll all just give everybody a little break and just, you know, reconnoiter in a few weeks.
Reconnoiter. You might be the first person to use that word on Radio Cherry Bomb. Well, you and Ben started cooking out of the kitchen at the Good Four.
Yeah.
And I remember walking down and I bought bags of frozen dumplings that I lived on for a very long time.
You got some kimchi too,
and kimchi.
Yeah, that's right.
I pretty much in the beginning of the pandemic lived on your dumplings and I would make sushi rice with kimchi and a fried egg on top.
Beautiful.
And then lots of whatever I had sprinkled on top. And I just lived on that and was happy, but panicked, you know.
But it's comfort food. It's good.
It was. But I remember being struck by the idea that so many of us were back to how things were when we started.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it felt like the beginning of Cherry Bomb all over again. You know, seeing you and Ben in the Good Fork, you know, space that Ben had built, that you two had rebuilt, seeing you in the kitchen, you know, doing this, I was like, wow, it's like we're all starting over again.
Yeah. Yeah. There was something really interesting about that, right? You're right. Everybody just sort of went back to their homes and their little places and started. It's like, okay, this is the place where we sort of waited out. And that for us, for Ben and I, was the Good Fork. And I sought solace in that because I was so busy with Gage and Tolner's launch that I actually wasn't able to pay a lot of attention to the Good Fork or even INSA for that matter. So it was really comforting to be there. And of course, you know, people in the restaurant industry, idle hands, like we go crazy. So I said to Ben, I was like, well, there's this fresh inventory. We should just at least just feed people, you know, whether we're just selling meals to go or, you know, doing donation meals for the local charities and the hospitals. And so it was really about just being active. And it really was awesome to be active in that tiny little space.
You've kind of explained why, but this was a huge project.
Yeah.
Why deep in your heart did you want to tackle this?
In the beginning, I talked about just the three of us, the partners. But then as soon as we had our vision down, I knew that we needed the team to be bigger. It's not just the three of us. So Adam Shepherd, our executive chef, came on board and he was working with me at INSA at the moment. So, and then we were looking for other key players. And I think I tapped Caroline Schiff too, or like 2 years prior, and she was in between jobs. And I was like, Caroline, this is something that we're working towards. Like, would you be into working with us on that? So they were all these like people and moving parts were coming together. And it really was, for me, the getter, the clincher was the food. Like, it just felt so exciting of an opportunity to put a menu together, to look over 125 years of menus, things that they served in that space over the years. And then really sort of like a culmination, I think, of my entire sort of culinary professional life, right? Started out, you know, working for a lot of great chefs out there and then branching out in 2006, opening the Good Fork with Ben. And then that was a very globetrotting menu, but that was very grounded in technique and classics. And I did INSA. And then it just felt like just full circle to tackle a traditional oyster chop house. But how can we bring this to the 21st century, put our sensibilities onto it? And that challenge was so exciting. Just the way that I found, you know, working on the Sunken Harbor Club prior to that, right? Because I had, like, as soon as St. John and I talked about Sunken Harbor Club, I, like, you know, wrote down some ideas and started cooking up, you know, researching. And it just, that's what I love to do. And I think ultimately all the chefs really, you know, the grind of, you know, hiring and payroll, all that stuff is the grind. And what I got into this industry is not for the business side of things. It really was because of the passion for food. And it was calling me. It was calling me. I didn't want to listen. I didn't want to, you know, answer that call. But I, you know, late at night, I would think about Edna Lewis, and I read all of her cookbooks again. And, you know, slowly but surely, I really was like, okay, we have to do this now. So that was fun.
Now we'll talk about the how and how you raised the money for what was probably your most expensive project to date.
Oh, by far.
You chose to do a sort of new form of crowdfunding, mm-hmm. and you chose a platform called WeFunder. Yep. Can you talk about that?
Sure. WeFunder is a platform where you could take a concept or an idea, a business idea, and get small investors. So the idea is that, you know, we tried to get some big fish, as they say, you know, but we realized that just within our circle of people and acquaintances and friends, we didn't know too many people who had lots and lots of money. But we knew that, you know, we could maybe have 500 people that could kick in a little. And WeFunder works sort of like Kickstarter, but it's an actual investment. You are, like, we promise to pay them back. So, but it's on a lower scale. So it starts at $1,000. And lo and behold, it was true. Our community sort of showed up and we raised close to $500,000.
From how many investors?
High 400s, a little less than 500. And notes, it sort of works like Kickstarter or, you know, some of the other platforms where you could leave little messages, like you could invest $1,000 and say, hey, had the most amazing meal at the Good Fork, or we got married there, or rehearsal, like all these memories, you know. And I was like, I know that person. Oh, that's my uncle who, you know, gave $2,000. And then there were all these people that we did not know. And that was tied to the legacy of Gage and Tolner. And then the story started pouring out. I got married upstairs at Gage and Tolner. My grandfather, you know, worked downtown, and that was our Sunday supper place. And these memories just flooded out. And it just was wonderful to see. It was just really heartwarming and wonderful. And that's when we decided that this was a real big sort of public project, that it's obviously not just for the three of us, but really it's about the importance of putting something back that has been missed for so long historically. So then there was this sense of sort of obligation to do it right. So it was very fortifying.
Does having 400 investors stress you out?
Oh my God. Like, especially when the pandemic hit, there was no question that we needed to do this. And honestly, if this was a smaller project and there was just the three of us and we're sort of invested and, you know, scraped together some money from friends and family, which is sort of how Ben and I opened INSA, then I think the pressure would be less, right? But because we opened with so many people's investments, we just felt awful, A, and B, like, demoralized that the future was so unclear. But I think that once we saw the light at the end of the tunnel, we were, yes, this has to be. We have to make it happen, and it's going to be better than how we ever envisioned it. So yes, the stress was there, the anxiety was there, but the push was there, and a sense of responsibility, big, and to do it proudly, you know what I mean? But it also felt like we were supported. Like, no one said, hey, what's happened? Like, no one was upset, obviously. They all understood it's a pandemic. But also, you know, just looking back over the history of Gage and Tolner, it survived two world wars. Think about it, 125 years. And it survived the pandemic of 1918. So we found strength in that. You know, St. John made a very eloquent sort of speech to our staff on the last day, saying so. So there was no question that we would just pick up where we left off. It just took longer than we thought.
When was the grand reopening?
The grand reopening, April of 15th of this year, 2021. So exactly 13 months after.
Let's talk about the menu.
Yeah.
I have eaten there a lot. What is on the menu?
So the menu is a revamped oyster and chop house for the 21st century. And that means that you open up the menu and you are really likely to see a lot of things that are familiar, comforting, and then some a little surprises. But the format of it is, we looked up a lot of old, even the way that the menu is laid out, we looked at a lot of old menu layouts. And so there's a lot of like throwback, looking back and also looking forward. So there is the amazing Edna Lewis made famous she crab soup, oysters Rockefeller, originated in Antoine's restaurant, but all the recipes are ours, and mainly Adam Shepherd.
Even Edna's, you put a little twist on it.
Yeah, well, you see, no one really knows what she put in her crab, she crab soup. I mean, you know, basically her she crab soup is like four items. It's like crab, sherry, cream, butter, and the roe, of course. So, and a lot of, obviously, you know, Edna Lewis is a superhero in that she took something very, very simple, all great ingredients, and just kept it simple. And that was her, sort of her magic touch. But so there's a lot of more technique involved. And, you know, all of us are sort of fine dining chefs and have that kind of sensibility and techniques up our sleeve. So not everything is as simple as it appears, but I think that's the beauty of it. So when you have something simple like, you know, she crab soup, there's 102 million ways to make it. But I think that most people are enjoying, you know, our version, but it's important that it's there, right? That it's not some other soup, but that it harks back to and pays homage to Edna Lewis.
Because you still have people who have eaten at the previous incarnation of Gage and Tolner, and I read the comments in the New York Times review.
Oh, yeah.
And they all have opinions as to what should be on the
menu. So many. And honestly, at a certain point, I was like, oh, okay, another person telling me what should be on the menu. So it was really hard. You know, we did a talk at the Brooklyn Historical Society, and all these people who've been there, they all came. And, you know, after the talk, there was a lot of questions about what we're going to have on the menu. And I think that was the most important thing. So I knew that it had to, you know, pay respect to a lot of menu items that have been there that people remember. And so you're playing to the memories. They don't know which recipe, you know, Edna Lewis used or exactly, you know, some people don't even remember, but a lot of people do remember, which is fascinating. Oh, and the other menu item that was key, and I could not keep it, you know, I couldn't keep it off the menu, is the soft belly broil, you know, and that dates back further than Edna Lewis's participation at Gage and Tolner. You know, like crab done 25 different ways, you know, but they all have different names. Or oysters broiled, you know, creamed, and some have celery. I mean, it's just a trip to look at all these, you know, old menus. But so we had to give it all these knots to different, you know, times, turn of the century, mid-century, Edna Lewis's stay there. And also, you know, paying homage to a lot of the past owners, you know, and what they sort of, you know, put on the menu in terms to sort of make it their own. But there were just definitely some solid, you know, we had to have a raw bar. Obviously, it was an oyster chop house. So you have to have the oysters, you know, the shrimp cocktail, and then the classic salads, right? The Caesar, the wedge. So they're accessible menu in terms of recognition, but we really, Adam and I really wanted to make sure that it was the best one. You know, if they had she crab soup 10 times, that we want it to be the best one that they had. Or like the best is like, I had the she crab soup by Edna Lewis here, and this was better than hers. Like, I've only gotten that once, and I think she was lying to me. That was the goal for us, is that how could we just make this, you know, simple oysters Rockefeller.
You also slip in some homages to your own culinary heritage.
Sure. But, you know, I think that is true of most modern, you know, contemporary chefs. Like, you look at your pantry, you look at your larder, and, you know, obviously kimchi to me is not just, it doesn't even belong to the realm of Korean cooking anymore. It just is in your kitchen, it's in your refrigerator, it's a condiment, you know. You put it on grilled cheese, and why not put a little bit, you know, onto the Clams Casino. And you know, that's actually Ben naming that Kimcino. He with every restaurant, he likes to name one dish after using my last name, Kimcino, but also it's kimchi.
What are some other examples where you did that?
Adam had a great idea of infusing the soft belly broil with miso. And so it's undetectable, really. It's not so strong and forward, but it's that certain umami, and that it's that certain quality of taste that, wow, this is really flavorful. So we sneak it in when we can, advertise it when we want.
I should mention for all the history buffs out there, you can look up the index to the New York Public Library's menu collection.
Oh, yes.
And they have over 26,000 menus dating back to the 1890s.
That's right.
So that's what you're referring to when you talk about the research.
Yeah, Brooklyn Library, Brooklyn Historical Society, it's all there. It's all there for you to see.
That must have been such a fun part of this project.
Such a fun part. And also when Ben was working on the upstairs, he was on the roof and found that there was this little tucked away room between the roof and the second floor or the third floor. And then out came five boxes, dusty, and it had all kinds of memorabilia. All kinds, awards, best restaurant for this, participation in that, special events menu, you know, written letters.
I mean, that's like something you see in a movie.
Oh, totally.
You find the box with all the treasures in it.
Oh, yes.
But this
absolutely.
Really happened.
This happened. And then recipes. Mrs. Dewey had a recipe for something and she would write it down. And who knows if they actually served that or not. It was their lives. Like you opened a box and you're like, it's a little piece of history right there. Just this is how they lived.
Let's talk about the New York Times review, because everyone in New York City waits for their New York Times review when they open a big project. Mm-hmm. Were you nervous?
No.
Did it matter? Because it's a different time right now in terms of reviews. And the New York Times did away with the star system for now.
Yeah, they did. The team, we're not nervous. We, you know, we don't cater, obviously, to reviewers. I figure that if a restaurateurs, chefs, operators, if you are true to your vision and your goal, and you know that that menu is as best as you could do, and that service that you provide is the best that you could provide, you've arrived. You know what I mean? So it's not about one person's opinion, really. I mean, I do respect Pete Wells, and I do respect his writing. Okay, I was a little nervous when I knew that it was coming out, but by the time that we opened, and I think because we had the practice, you know, 14 months prior, that we knew that we could get this right. But of course, every day you tweak things and you know, every day is a different challenge. By the time we got reviewed, we were very, very solid on what we were providing. And we felt very proud of that. And of course, just crossing your fingers and hoping that, you know, everybody enjoys it. So whether it's Pete Wells or, you know, that wonderful couple that celebrated their anniversary there 50 years ago, you know, like one of their earlier anniversaries, like we made that the same importance. And I think that's how you have to really approach it.
I only bring up the review because it was a beautiful review and
it really
gave you
was.
So much real estate in the food section.
Yeah.
And just the headline, I had to look it up again. A Brooklyn landmark holds its head high again.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
everybody who was rooting for you and who has followed you from Good Fork version one, Good Fork version two. And, you know, we didn't even talk about how much you and Ben have been through as restaurateurs and small business owners.
Yeah.
You know, the Good Fork was destroyed during Hurricane Sandy and you had to rebuild.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for those of us who are part of that community and knew what had happened the first time around, we were just like, how could this happen to them again?
I know.
They're such good people and they went through this once already.
But it happened to everybody, though. You
this
know?
Time.
Yeah, this time. So, you know, and there's resilience, right? There's sort of built-in resilience. And I think that, you know, whether you go through something as traumatic as, you know, Sandy and having your sort of getting your restaurant, seeing your restaurant destroyed and having to rebuild, whether it's that or just, I think anybody who operates restaurants in the truest sense, really good restaurants, I think that they know that it's always like two steps forward, one step back. So there is something really that is built in, like, okay, you don't expect a pandemic to just, you know, shut you down overnight, but okay, it's just another hurdle that we have to get through. But thank goodness for the wonderful team that we're surrounded by. If it wasn't for them, I don't think we would have made it.
Even though I'm sure you have a lot more that you will accomplish in your life, when I look back at what you've done, the through line is community. 100%.
Yeah, thank you for seeing that, because it is important for us. In fact, just yesterday, you know, as you know, the Good Fork is no more, but we still hold the lease. And we've been trying to, you know, make sure that the restaurant gets sort of passed on to another operator that will, you know, do us proud and do something amazing in that lovely, awesome, handmade, built place, you know, by us, by Ben. So we threw a party yesterday, and our dear friend George Motz did his burger sliders, and I made dumplings and to order. And we got our friend Ray to DJ, and Miss Mona Ice Cream was there and sort of blasted out via social media and MailChimp, just letting people know that we're having this pop-up party. And so many people showed up. And it really was, every time we do this like every 3 months, it seems like, you know, until we really have to let the space go. But it was so great. Like customers and friends and family that, you know, we know through not just the Good Fork, but of INSA and also Gage. And, you know, yesterday I answered so many questions. questions about, you know, how INSS is doing and how Gage is doing, and fielding congratulations from everybody about all the accolades. And it really, it was a big full circle moment for me and Ben yesterday. People care, which is how we survive.
Let's talk about Edna Lewis a little bit more.
Yeah.
What did you uncover about Edna that really has stuck with you?
Well, you know, my favorite cookbook is Taste of Country Cooking. And to me, that is so much about Edna and who she is, was, you know, not just because that's about her childhood, how she grew up in this small town, you know, how they harvested, how they cooked, how they, you know, talk about community, what they did for church, you know, events, and you know, what a simple, typical dinner meal looks like. I felt like I sort of knew about Edna Lewis, but I feel like I really didn't. And I discovered that she was a chef, you know, at some really high profile restaurants in Manhattan. And then when she made the trek to Brooklyn, downtown to Gage and Tolner, it was really at the invitation of Peter Ashkenazi, who was the then owner, you know, went to an event where Edna Lewis cooked, you know, for the event. And he sort of hounded her and said, "You have to come here and be the chef."
We had his ex-wife, Marcy Bloom,
who talked all about that.
Marcy's the best.
Yes. And, you know, Peter's been very encouraging and very supportive. And they came the first week that we reopened and loved it. So there's a lot of support there. But it really was just finding out her trajectory, like how she started, you know, what she did in Manhattan, you know, what she cooked, like she could cook an amazing, you know, French meal, you know, and do beautiful souffles. And then she was, you know, and then the soul food, you know, the Southern cooking that she was a master of, and just her philosophy, you know, and the kind of person that she was. She was politically active, cool lady with a beautiful smile, you know, had the bourbon every night with a long cigarette. And I just feel like she's such a cool lady. You know, she wasn't an uber chef. She just was an honest to goodness cook. And she loved doing it.
Her niece told us that she would come out in the dining room, but really did not love coming out in the dining
room.
But people loved seeing her.
Yeah. And, you know, I am no Edna Lewis, but sometimes I'm forced to go into the dining room and I hate it. This is a reason why I decided to cook a long time ago so I could hide out in the kitchen. And so I sort of found that to be true, too. Like somehow maybe we're kindred spirits. And, you know, this is all just me, you know, conjecturing in my mind. And, you know, I've never had the privilege of meeting her before she passed. But there was a lot of, you know, just sensing her vibe in that space. So
do you talk to her when you're in the kitchen?
Oh, yeah. All the time, especially in the beginning. And then to hear all these stories, I have some friends who actually, when they came to New York after college, they worked at Gage and Tolner and they had the privilege of knowing her and, like, you know, she taught them how to bake pies and such. So all these stories I just revel in.
We have to talk about Caroline Schiff for a second.
Of
because
course.
She's a good friend to Cherry Bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And we love her dessert menu mm-hmm. and the bread menu there.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a cookbook coming out very soon.
Mm-hmm.
I have to confess, I laughed so hard when I read Pete Wells' description of her baked Alaska. I thought it was kind of mean.
She was not pleased.
I have to say, maybe she won't listen to this episode, but he said, almost every table seems to get the brown blob the size of a well-fed house cat.
I remember the thing about the kale slaw. Where, you know, he talks about the kimchi and a couple of applications, and he accepted it for the clams casino, but he said with the kale slaw that it needed to go through the wood chipper once more. I was like, ouch, hello.
But every table literally does order it.
Oh my God, as
it
you
is
should.
A big baked Alaska.
Absolutely. I'm just going to think that maybe he's just not a big baked Alaska fan. You know, I'm not a big sweet, you know, like ice cream meringue type person.
Bring it on.
I know.
I love it.
Yeah. I have to try and I have to have it, but certainly it is big. It's originally for two. I think she did make it a little smaller. I mean, we played around with the size of it. But, you know, just the work of making three different handmade ice creams, you know, really interesting flavors, the combinations all going well together, and that crazy Swiss meringue. And when you, you know, when you put the torch to it, it's just beautiful color. And I think it sort of looks like her hair, like she's sort of known for this amazing blob of just hair always gorgeous. And
her Anna of Green Gables meets Kate Bush hairdo.
Totally. She's a force, man.
Almost every table seems to end their meal with that. And I think it is such a testament to the restaurant because it's just celebratory from
start to finish.
Right. And you know, when I asked Caroline to join the team, she was super excited. And we talked about direction and we talked about history and we looked at a lot of, you know, dessert menus, dessert items that were, that went out of the kitchens of Gage and Tolner through different eras. But there were a few things that I really sort of wanted her to do. And that was one of the main ones. I was like, I feel very strongly that we need to have a version of Baked Alaska. And so, and I think that it's the best Baked Alaska I've ever had. She's super talented, a great hard worker. And, you know, she was the first cooking job she ever had was at the Good Fork.
I know. She's always talked about you as a mentor.
You know, that's why we do this, right? For these relationships. And yeah, it's about the space. It's about the how. It's about the food. It's about the business. But at the end of the day, it's really a business of people, right? Not just serving guests and making sure that they have an amazing time for the 2-3 hour duration or however long for that particular meal. But it really is about, like you said, community for us. And it's about these relationships and working with lovely people that we've, you know, worked with in the past and people that, and new people that you've always wanted to work with. And so long as everybody's visions align and that we provide a great place to work, hopefully that is a great recipe, you know, for success for a behemoth project like Gage and Tolner. So, you know, every day is a challenge, but when you look around and you're surrounded by such amazing people, you're like, all right, we're going to get through this.
Let's do a speed round.
Okay.
Most treasured cookbook.
Well, I mean, having talked about Edna Lewis, it has to be A Taste of Country Cooking.
Favorite or most used kitchen implement?
That's hard. I mean, my knife, I'm just really stuck on my friend who makes knives, Ruby Knives. I love his knives.
Song that makes you smile.
We Belong by Pat Benatar, because it is my to-go karaoke song.
Is it?
Yes, and I just smile and laugh, and I know most of the words.
That's a good song. Do you, music in the kitchen, pro, con?
Well, yes. During prep, absolutely. During service, nay.
What do you play?
Anything. It depends on who you're prepping with, right? Back in the days, I had this great sort of hip-hop mix from the 80s, you know, Salt and Pepper and, you know, all these throwback 80s vibe sounds. Like, that's what I like to hear. And then, of course, my cooks are like, really? Are we going to listen to Madonna again?
You said, shut up. It's my restaurant.
That's right. Child of the 70s and 80s.
Dream travel destination.
I want to go to the Maldives.
Oh, why?
You know, I just talked about this with my 12-year-old son, and he brought it up. And I was like, how did you hear about Maldives? And he didn't know exactly where it was. So we looked at it on the map, and we looked up some Google images, and he said, oh my God, that place looks like paradise.
Is that where they have the hotels over the water?
Yeah.
Yes. And those come?
Yes. Yeah. Let's all go.
Okay. Okay. What is the oldest thing in your fridge at home?
Oh God, my kimchi. Stinking. I think that particular one is like 2 years old. I only bring it up for when I want to make that really funky kimchi stew.
When are you going to bottle that stuff and sell it?
I don't know. I guess that's the next thing. I do think about it a lot.
Not that you need another project, but I buy other people's kimchi in a supermarket. I'd rather buy yours.
Oh, thank you for that. I think I'm pretty proud of my kimchi game. I'll look into that.
Okay.
You know.
You're like, let me add that to the list of things people tell me to do all day long. Okay, last question. If you had to be trapped on a desert island with one food celebrity, who would it be and why?
Oh, God. I want to say Anthony Bourdain. I'd love to have a chat with him about various things, food fads, his favorite foods. I never met him, but I, you know, obviously it was such a devastating loss. I have a lot of questions for him.
I think we all do.
Yeah.
Well, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you for coming to Rock Center and hanging out with us today.
Fun.
And I can't wait to harass Alex again for more reservations.
You keep doing
that.
But
you can make a reservation on Resy. I should say that.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not impossible.
Resy Notify is the best.
Yes, it is.
Do you take walk-ins?
You know what? Yes, we do. And I said that yesterday. I'm going to tell you, we were just mentioned by the New York Times as 50 best restaurants in this country. Such an honor. And then at the same time, Eater, you know, put us on their 38 hot list, essential list. So I think people who've never heard of us before, they're discovering that we're there. Normally, I would say yes to walk-in tables, especially at 5 o'clock when we open. But I gave that advice to a friend of mine who asked me for a reservation. I said, it'd totally fill up. But if you get there at like 4:50 and be the first person there, I'm like 100% sure that you could, you know, get a reservation. And then she got there 4:50 and sent me a picture because I wasn't there at the restaurant at the time. I was running a little late. And there was a line out the door, like surround, like down the block to Smith Street and around. And I was like, wow, the power of publicity. And but it's not impossible. And I think that just like if you're reviewed by a certain magazine or newspaper, it takes a little while. You just have to be a little bit patient, but it's not impossible.
Well, well-deserved, Sohee. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Carrie. So fun talking to you.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
That's it for today's show. Thank you so much to Sohee Kim of Gage & Tolner and INSA for stopping by. You can snag Sohee's cookbooks or visit her Brooklyn restaurants if you are in the New York City area. Thank you to Carrie Gold and Sir Kensington's for supporting our show. Radio Cherry Bomb is recorded at Newsstand Studios at Rockefeller Center in New York City. Thank you to Joseph Hazen, studio engineer for Newsstand Studios, and to our assistant producer, Jenna Sadu. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.